You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, the director of FSI and your host of World Class. Today, as America struggles to confront the threats posed by hacking and online disinformation campaigns in the run-up to our midterm elections, I have the pleasure of welcoming to the podcast Ambassador Eileen Donahoe. Eileen is the executive director of our Global Digital Policy Incubator at the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law, a center at FSI. GDPI focuses on developing policies that address challenges to human rights, security, and governance. Before joining FSI, Eileen was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva during the Obama administration. Eileen, Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike.
So let's start with some basics to kind of level set here. Election hacking. There's growing concern about digital technologies being used to undermine the integrity of elections, not just here in America, but globally. How do you frame the threat of digital technology to democratic processes and to democratic governance?
So first point is that it is very understandable, justifiable, that we in the United States are really preoccupied with our own midterm election, especially in light of what we've learned recently about the extent of foreign intervention in the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. And so we're still a little freaked out about that. But I think it's really important as a first point to pick our heads up and recognize this really is a global phenomenon. It's playing out around the world. We've seen it in elections in Macedonia, in Kenya. Just recently, this past weekend, the presidential election in Brazil. And the threat of digital technology being used to undermine democratic processes really is a global threat. We are a very important data point. But we're not the only one, and we really have to keep that global perspective to address the threat. In terms of the question of how to frame the challenge, not only in the United States, but globally.
And who's responsible for tackling the challenge, right? That's always a hard question.
That is a really big question because the private sector now owns, operates, and secures much of the information infrastructure in the country. The internet has become the means of communicating. And they are responsible for securing that. And so we are all dependent upon them for new roles and responsibilities that we never envisioned, they never envisioned. Before we even get to that new role and responsibility of the private sector, we've got to sort of tease out the parts of the problem.
Okay.
And I
do a little teasing for us.
Well, I look at it sort of as three big buckets of challenges, sort of three different vectors of attack. They're interrelated, but they need to be separated if we're going to find solutions. The first big bucket is hacking of critical infrastructure, election infrastructure, sort of the machines, or even hacking of campaign confidential communications. It's sort of
like happened in 2016 in our presidential
with
election.
With gargantuan effects.
Right.
That actually is a really good example of how these buckets bleed into each other because it was the hacking of that confidential communication that was then doxed and bled into the information ecosystem.
Help our listeners understand the word doxed.
Doxed is basically when communication that is intended to be personal and confidential is put out in the public and is used as almost bait to distract people from more serious issues. I mean, in fact, we were talking about John Podesta's polenta recipes, et cetera. You know, so there was not a whole lot of meaningful stuff in that material, and yet it successfully distracted the public and the mainstream media. It kind of hacked the mainstream media during a critical part of our election period in 2016. So that's a good example of the bleeding. But I want to go back to the critical infrastructure challenge. Part of why it's so hard to address that in the United States is because states, counties, townships are actually responsible for protecting election infrastructure and actually setting it up.
And we don't have one system that does it all.
It's not a federalized system. It's not a national system. And, you know, in effect, these local actors are up against the Russian FSB on their own. And so we really have to take a national look at the cybersecurity critical infrastructure threat.
Okay.
Middle category.
So that's bucket number one.
That's now, bucket number one.
Now bucket number two.
Bucket number two is the one that many, many, many people are preoccupied with, which is what I call the hack of civic discourse.
Okay.
It's the disinformation threat. It is information operations, malign foreign actors reaching across borders to infiltrate our civic discourse with fabricated personas, inauthentic amplifiers, micro-targeting tools. And there's this bizarre way in which they mix with authentic civic discourse and then intentionally create polarization, division, and confusion. That one is really hard to solve for a different reason. In democracy, access to information, free expression, it's supposed to be the lifeblood of our society, of our political discourse. And now information is being weaponized against democratic processes. And so there's just a lot of confusion about how do we simultaneously protect free expression and democratic processes.
Right.
And then third big bucket is an even more abstract kind of concept. I think of it as undermining confidence in the integrity of democratic processes, in the integrity of information in the political sphere, and even in democratic governance itself and our institutions. And to me, that is the end game. You know, the attack on critical infrastructure, the hacking of civic discourse, all of that is intended to ultimately erode confidence in democratic governance itself. And unfortunately, it is succeeding at this particular moment in time.
And just to be clear, it's succeeding in part because those that don't support democracy can use and access these platforms because we're an open society, right? Whereas the more closed societies, they're more immune from it? Or is it actually a problem for all societies and all systems of government?
Wow, that's a great question. I think we're more vulnerable on lots of levels. One is the point you just made about the openness of our. We believe in, you know, open access to information, free expression. We let information out. And we are also vulnerable because of the extent of our digitization. Everything has been digitized. All of it is now vulnerable, and we have not figured out how to bring a sense of security, whether it's to personal communications, critical infrastructure, or really any dimensions of our society that have been digitized. They're all vulnerable. But to your point, your question about closed societies, what's really going on there is that there's still a very proactive to poison civic discourse in those societies as well. So they're not immune to this. They don't have the level of vulnerability we do. And in fact, the authoritarian actors are controlling the information space exceedingly well with digital technology. But the poisonous atmosphere, the polarization, the division, the incitement to violence, it, again, playing out around the world. We see it in Myanmar, India, you know, all over.
Well, that is part of the paradox here, isn't it? Because it wasn't too long ago when we thought about these technologies as being enhancing democracy. Our colleague Larry Diamond used to have a program. I don't know if he still does. It was called Liberation Technology, right? These were supposed to liberate people. What do you think happened along the way?
That is a really hard one for me to answer because it's very personal and disheartening to me, because I was among those kind of, you know, technology optimists.
Right.
I fell right into that. I happened to have been in Geneva at the UN, at the Human Rights Council, at the pinnacle of the internet freedom movement. And
well, you were a part of it, right, with Secretary Clinton.
Absolutely.
She had a big statement on that. I can't remember what year that was.
She started in 2011. And interestingly, in 2012, I actually brought a whole delegation of ambassadors from Geneva to Stanford. And we did a big event to kind of socialize the ambassadors in the concept of internet freedom.
I see.
And hard to believe, 2012, a lot of these ambassadors didn't even use email at the time. So it's kind of crazy.
And that is crazy.
And they live in societies that are not digitally connected. So, you know, we have to remember half the globe at this moment in time is still not connected. So what
I
we're
didn't know that. That's
yes,
an interesting point.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in any event, the 2012, we actually co-led a big resolution, the first UN resolution on internet freedom, laying down this foundational concept that human rights must be protected online as offline. So very much to the issue of free expression, freedom of assembly and association.
Right.
And we really all thought, because at that time, civil society was way ahead of the curve.
Right.
And way ahead of authoritarian governments in utilizing digital technology for their work. And what has happened since is authoritarians have caught up and now are shockingly effective in utilizing this technology to repress their societies. But another thing that I have to say we failed to recognize is that there would be so many other kinds of malign actors who would get into this space, whether they're digital mercenaries, you know, doing wreaking havoc for money, you know, troll farms and non-state actors all getting into the mix. And I think it was really a failure of imagination on our part. Simple point being technology is dual natured.
Right.
And it, and we forgot that it could be capitalized on for malign purposes.
Right.
And the big digital mega platforms were thought of as technologies of connection and liberation.
Right.
I think they have really woken up now and understand that they have new responsibilities and new roles and responsibilities really to not just their own users, but to democracy and to larger society, because they're having a massive effect on the quality of life for all of us.
Right. So it's a bigger burden than they thought. And I mean, you know, this the Silicon Valley, well, there was an ethos of optimism from these companies, right? So it wasn't just you and the government and the Clinton administration. They too have that spirit, but now they're confronting these challenges.
Oh, definitely. Their self-identity was, you know, they were for good. They were forces for good.
Right.
And connectivity was inherently beneficial.
Right.
And they failed to recognize the security consequences of just being digitized and being connected.
Right.
A big part of it, there's some really interesting features of our globalized, digitized world that make us really vulnerable. And the one obvious one is instantaneous extraterritorial reach for anyone, anywhere, with capacity to affect the freedom or security of anyone anywhere else. That's one
thing. That's a new dimension, right? That was not around 30 years ago.
No.
Right.
And then the other point we said earlier is just digitization. I think people assumed it was creating efficiencies and economic upside. Nobody understood the security vulnerabilities that would flow from that. And so we're still catching up to that in every dimension, you know, election infrastructure, personal communications, you know, IP, every dimension of our society is vulnerable.
Once it becomes digitized, financial too, right?
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the government responses. So what's interesting or paradoxical or challenging here is that you have platforms that are global, as you just said, but you don't have a global approach to how to regulate these things, right? Different governments, the Germans on the one hand, the Facebook law, they call it, the European Union versus the United States. And then we have these other actors, Russia and China in the mix. this is a huge question, but how do you kind of assess how they're doing so far, and what are some of the challenges of having global platforms but individual countries trying to address it?
So first point I would make is that there is this very complex interplay between national law within jurisdictions, the policies, practices, and product algorithms of private sector platforms, okay, community guidelines, terms of service, that are on their, they constitute a form of governance. I mean, these platforms, okay, are like quasi-sovereigns,
right,
that control the parameters of speech on their platforms. And on the other hand, their own policies and their own terms of service are their own speech, constitutes their own speech.
Well, that's a great point.
How that interplays with national laws is very complicated. And then I would add the third piece is international law. We have international norms that protect free expression, mm-hmm, protect privacy, and there is basically a conflict between all three of these things happening right now. And there's confusion about whether national governments get to dictate whether private sector platforms not only will respect their laws on content or privacy within their borders, but extend them globally. There have been several moves to extend global,
right,
jurisdiction,
right,
in the name of protecting their own citizens. So that's a whole bucket of jurisdictional challenges, mm-hmm, that we've barely begun to scratch the surface on.
Are there some examples of some good things that are happening legally that out there, or is it mostly confusion?
That's a great question.
The EU, the GDPR.
Yeah, I mean, GDPR.
Tell our listeners about that. Just
GDPR is the EU regulation that protects the data of citizens within the EU. Mm-hmm. And it really is becoming a model, a global model. In fact, in the state of California, we recently passed a resolution, a law that mimics GDPR.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
We're one of the first. Unfortunately, also, though, I would say what's happening in many other places around the world is the opposite. It's more the authoritarian move.
Right.
And utilization of this technology not to protect the liberty of citizens, the security of citizens, but to control citizens.
Right.
And I think we really have a battle going on between these models. I mean, some people, you know, Eric Schmidt has recently talked about the risk that not that far down the road, we're going to have a split between the Chinese model of internet governance for their own citizens, and they're also exporting that,
right,
model. That's going to take up one part of the world. And the other part of the world he envisioned will be U.S.-led. It will be more the internet freedom, the open, interoperable internet.
Right. Eric Schmidt's the former chairman of Google, for our listeners who don't know who he is. So it sounds a little bit like a Cold War standoff.
It could be. And unfortunately, the consequences of that Cold War really hurt those who wanted global connectivity to,
right,
be a force for good.
Right.
So on some level, that fragmentation is a loss right there. I'm actually concerned about another piece of it, which is the EU has, because they've taken the lead on data protection in many ways, and they're looking at regulating technology companies in ways that are not copacetic in the United States,
mm-hmm,
there's a risk that we end up with three models.
Three.
So there, you know, there's
so the
almost
West will be divided too.
And the West will be divided.
Wow.
And that has gargantuan consequences.
It doesn't sound like a win-win outcome. It sounds like a zero-sum outcome. Well, let's talk. So why GDPI then, to the Global Digital Policy Incubator? What do you hope to achieve with GDPI here at Stanford?
So we are basically a collaboration hub.
Mm-hmm.
We are global in scope. we see that digital technology is inherently global. And so we have to be thinking about governance and solutions in from a global vantage point. We also are committed to this concept of multi-stakeholder dialogue.
Right. Sounds like it has to be from what you've been talking about, right?
Exactly. And I think that we see confusion among democratic governments who are no longer confident that they can simultaneously protect freedom, security, and democratic processes.
Right.
But that's their responsibility. We've got private sector platforms who are grappling with new roles and responsibilities, and they really need help incorporating values that come from democratic society, and I would argue universal human rights norms,
right,
and help make them manifest on their platforms. And they're really looking for help. And then last but not least, we try to bring civil society to the table and make sure they're part of the conversation.
Right.
Yeah. And luckily, good news, bad news is this is such a rich and fascinating topic, multi-layered topic. There are people clamoring for help. And I would even argue the best and the brightest around the world are really coming to this subject because there's nothing more important at this juncture.
Well, congratulations to be in the mix. I mean, it is hard to think of a set of issues that are more important to the 21st century than the ones that you're trying to tackle at GDPI. So, Eileen, thanks for joining us here on World Class. We wish you well. We'll check in with you from time to time to see what new developments are there. And thank you again for coming to World Class.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.